From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The war in Bosnia is escalating. There is renewed fighting around Sarajevo. Over 300 UN peacekeepers are still being held hostage by the Bosnian Serbs, who have canceled all their agreements with the UN. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with journalist Roger Cohn of the New York Times, who is in Sarajevo. Cohn says the air is thick with nervous tension and uncertainty. Today he woke up to the sound of shelling and could hear NATO planes overhead. Also on our show, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews new summer thrillers by John Grisham and Katherine Harrison. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Officials in Texas say a military plane crashed into an apartment complex in Wichita Falls today. The building caught on fire. Four people were killed, three in the building and another in a vehicle. Nine other people have been hurt. The plane's two crew members ejected. They sustained minor injuries. Parts of the wrecked plane came to rest at the front door of an elementary school. It had closed for the summer. President Clinton says that U.S. ground troops could be deployed to Bosnia to help United Nations peacekeepers take up safer positions in the region. Mr. Clinton says he's willing to dispatch troops if the United States is asked, but he told the graduating class of the Air Force Academy today the United States hasn't received any such request.
I want to say to you, we have obligations to our NATO allies, and I do not believe we can leave them in the lurch. So I must carefully review any request for an operation involving a temporary use of our ground forces. But we have made the right decision in what we have done and what we have not done in Bosnia.
Meanwhile, the United Nations Secretary General has drafted a report with several options for Bosnia. Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali suggests that peacekeepers could be replaced by a multinational force authorized to use firepower. He says it could be commanded by the countries that contribute troops. There were two new indicators today that the economy is slowing, perhaps even more than expected. NPR's Carol Ann Clark-Kelly reports.
Revised figures from the Commerce Department show the economy growing at an annual rate of 2.7% in the first quarter. That's slightly weaker than original estimates, and a surprise for many analysts who had been expecting the gross domestic product to be revised higher rather than lower. The first quarter growth rate is the slowest in a year and a half and considerably weaker than the 5.1% rate for the final quarter of 94. The Commerce Department also reported that new home sales fell 2.7% in April, despite falling interest rates. 30-year fixed-rate mortgages have been falling steadily to an average of 7.85%, down from over 9% in December. But new home sales in April were down in all regions except the Midwest. I'm Carol Ann Clark-Kelly in Washington.
Billionaire Kirk Kerkorian has withdrawn his takeover offer for Chrysler Corporation. He says his corporation wants to evaluate the situation. The takeover offer has been rejected by Chrysler's board. Doctors for actor Christopher Reeve say he is paralyzed and cannot breathe on his own. He broke his neck in a horse riding accident last Saturday. His physician says he suffered multiple fractures to the top two vertebrae in the neck and injured his spinal cord. The doctors won't speculate on what Reeve's chances for recovery are. On Wall Street, the Dow was up 75 points at 4,454. Trading is very heavy. This is NPR. A U.S. official says the United States will hold trade talks with Japan in Geneva next month. Both sides will try to resolve their trade dispute. The development comes a day after Japan's trade minister sent a letter to Trade Representative Mickey Cantor, urging him to rescind plans for punitive tariffs against Japanese luxury cars. The letter also asked for early talks and rejected a U.S. plan to hold talks later in June, just a few days before the tariffs are supposed to begin. Both U.S. and Japanese trade delegates met at the World Trade Organization's new dispute settlement body today. A panel of top scientists and corporate executives have called on the Defense Department to make its navigation satellites available for commercial use. The Pentagon currently prevents civilians from using the satellites' full capabilities. NPR's Dan Charles reports.
The new report was issued by the National Academy of Public Administration and the National Academy of Sciences. It deals with the Global Positioning System, or GPS, a fleet of 24 satellites. GPS receivers use radio signals from those satellites to calculate their exact position. The Defense Department makes some of these radio signals freely available, but it tampers with them, making the system far less accurate for civilian users than it could be. Pentagon officials say that's to keep very accurate guidance out of the hands of the nation's enemies. But according to this new report, such military priorities are outweighed by the system's potential benefits for the civilian economy. Civilian users of GPS, says the report, should have just as accurate a navigation system as the military. This is Dan Charles in Washington.
Negotiators to peace talks between Israel and the Palestinians say they're deadlocked today over the scope of the powers of the Palestinian authorities in Gaza and the West Bank. But negotiators say they'll pick up the talks again next week in Cairo to try to resolve their differences. Palestinians are warning the negotiations are threatened over commerce. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The war in Bosnia has reached a new stage, and it is unclear what's going to happen next. Over 350 UN peacekeepers are being held hostage by the Bosnian Serbs. The peacekeepers were taken in retaliation for last week's two NATO airstrikes against Serb munitions sites. The Bosnian Serbs have annulled all their agreements with the UN. U.S. warships and Marines are stationed in the waters near Bosnia. Today, President Clinton said he would be willing to use American ground troops to help withdraw UN peacekeepers or move them to safer positions. Earlier today, we phoned Sarajevo to speak with Roger Cohen, who was covering the war for The New York Times. When our conversation began, it was 5:15 p.m. in Sarajevo.
I'm speaking from the Holiday Inn in the middle of Sarajevo, which is a rather curious Holiday Inn. One side of it has been blown off, but it's the place where journalists who cover the war in Bosnia from Sarajevo generally stay. It's not in a very good position in that it's in front of a crossroads where there's generally a lot of sniping, but it does have a good garage and they try to keep up minimum services, and as yet the sides and back of it have not been hit by any heavy shells of any kind, and so three sides of the building remain operative, though not on the lower floors. So that's where I'm speaking to you from.
What's it been like in Sarajevo today? Has there been much fighting in or around the city?
Well, I was woken this morning at about 4:30 by a series of very loud explosions. After a couple of relatively quiet days, the Serbs and Muslims in a front-line position up above the Holiday Inn on the other side of the Miljatska River started exchanging mortar and rocket fire, and there was also a lot of machine gun fire and light weapons. And that went on for about an hour, hour and a half. It was extremely loud, but in fact, none of the shells fell on the central area of the city. It was confined to this frontline position. I would say in general that the town is extremely tense. There's a sense of drifting, being in a ship out on the seas and not quite knowing where it's going. The city is surrounded, as it has been for 3 years, by the Bosnian Serbs. There have been a series of very grave incidents in recent days. The United Nations force here is in a state of unprecedented nervousness. When you approach their bases, they will point weapons at you if you're driving in white armored vehicles, such as most journalists have, simply because the Serbs in recent days, in taking hostages, have also taken a large number of United Nations vehicles, and nobody knows quite who's who. The people here are exhausted. People just don't have the psychological reserves anymore or the adrenaline to keep on going. The streets are almost empty. There are NATO planes circling overhead. And the city, I would say, as a whole, is in a state of nervous exhaustion.
Where did you go today?
I went to the daily briefing, which is given by the United Nations press offices at 11 a.m. That's held about 4 kilometers from the hotel, down a road that's known as Sniper's Alley. Most of the journalists, and certainly the major news organizations, all have armored bulletproof vehicles. bulletproof up to about 12-millimeter caliber weapons. And so I traveled in that down to the briefing, and I listened to the briefing, and came back to the hotel, and then went out to the old city and had something to eat, and then went to a rather extraordinary briefing given by some French officers relating to a commando attack that these French peacekeepers decided to mount last Saturday when their camp between the Bosnian government and Serb lines was taken over by some Serbs disguised as peacekeepers. And for the first time, perhaps history, I'm not sure, but certainly in this conflict, United Nations peacekeepers in blue helmets turned themselves into a commando unit, and you had French United Nations soldiers clambering over barbed wire into a hail of bullets as they sought to recapture this position. The French suffered 2 dead, the Serbs suffered 4 dead. Of the 20 French who went into this hail of bullets, as I said, 2 died, 9 were injured, so that's 11 out of 20. And a very complex negotiation followed. Eventually they got back the whole of the unit, but they still have 10 peacekeepers held hostage. And I think when the American government calls for airstrikes, and clearly the mandate states that when Sarajevo is being shelled, airstrikes can and should be called for, I think perhaps it's difficult to comprehend what it's like for the European, particularly British and French governments, who are the guys who have people here on the ground and who suffer the kinds of reprisals that happens as peacekeepers. They were not expecting that.
Roger Cohn is my guest, New York Times reporter based in Sarajevo. He's joining us by phone. You wrote today in the New York Times that the Bosnian Serbs edged closer to a formal state of war with the UN peacekeepers, declaring them an enemy. What would it mean for the Serbs to go to war with the UN?
Well, in many ways, I think the Serbs have gone to war with the UN over the past week. That is the extraordinary change that has taken place here. In a sense, I think the Bosnian Serbs, who've been very adept at pushing to the limits and then pulling back, I think for many people in NATO, for the American government, for Western European governments, they have, in a sense, crossed the Rubicon and find themselves and pushed everyone else also into new territory. Now, they've come out just now in Pale and said they'd like to hold talks on the 400 hostages. My impression here is that there is such a feeling of anger and surprise, really, at what the Serbs have done, the extent of what they've done, that any suggestion of talks until the hostages have been released will be dismissed out of hand. General Rupert Smith, who is the British commander of United Nations troops here, seems to have a very firm hand. He's less inclined to bend and negotiate than his predecessor, Lieutenant General Sir Michael Rose. And that, I think, is a crucial difference. I would doubt that we're going to see negotiations. I think the Clinton administration, French government, British government, all Western governments are united in the position that first these 400 peacekeepers must be released. Then we'll see.
Do you think that the UN or NATO will use force to free those UN peacekeepers?
I think it could come to that. I don't think it's likely to happen in the next few days, Terry, but I think it could come to that. It's very difficult in that they're being held at a number of different positions, probably at least 20, and many of these hostages have not been able to speak, almost all of them, in fact, have not been able to speak with their units for since they were taken. So it would be a very difficult operation to mount. But I think that the pressure will be maintained on the Bosnian Serbs. We still have NATO jets flying overhead. We have, as I said, a united position from the Clinton administration and its allies that there will be no negotiation. And I think that possibly also the negotiations in Belgrade, where an American envoy is trying to persuade President Milosevic to break completely with the Bosnian Serbs and recognize Bosnia, that too could put pressure on the Serbs. But The Serbs in Pale have already shown that they are irrational, they are unpredictable. They're capable of extreme violence. Witness the shelling of the northern Bosnian town of Tuzla after the NATO bombing, in which 71 Bosnian kids, youngest 3, oldest 28, were killed by a single shell lobbed into the middle of a town. Now, this is the tactic that the Bosnian Serbs have used from the outset. And these are people who are capable of terror, who use terror as a weapon. That doesn't mean that a lot of people haven't tried to understand their case, the fact that they didn't want to leave Yugoslavia, they didn't want to be part of a country that they felt would be dominated by a Muslim government. People, I think, some people anyway, have tried to comprehend their case, but the brutality, savagery, ruthlessness against civilians with which they've tried to push their case has, I think, estranged almost everyone. And it's now culminated with their behavior over the past week. And I think any last sympathizers they may have had have probably been lost.
New York Times reporter Roger Cohn is joining us from Sarajevo. What mix of reactions to the peacekeepers have you found that the Bosnians have?
Well, Terry, it's very mixed. They recognize in Sarajevo 300,000 people, European city, very civilized people on the whole, educated, used to, I don't say a Western European lifestyle, but something pretty close to that. The Olympics were held here in 84, and they've been surrounded for 3 years. The only way out of here, when they can get out through it, is a tunnel that goes out of the airport. They are rats in a hole. They're even made to go through a hole to get out of here. So they have this vast UN presence here, and they're grateful to the UN to some extent for feeding them and for helping them in a humanitarian way. And they recognize that the macaroni and coffee and other food that they get helps them to survive. On the other hand, they are very angry that the international community, so-called, has left them surrounded in siege-like conditions for 3 years. There's been tremendous loss of life here, women, children, young men. You scarcely meet a family that hasn't lost somebody. Over 10,000 people killed here. And so that resentment against the international community is often leveled at the United Nations, which is the embodiment, rightly or wrongly, for the people of Sarajevo, of the international community here. You hear more and more people saying that they despise the UN. And you look out on the streets of a European city, you don't see a vehicle. You just see these white armored personnel carriers of the UN. And the people here feel they've been taken over and that this could stretch out eternally. They're at the end of their rope. Psychologically, it's been very cruel to have the conditions here improve, not greatly, but significantly for a period of months, and then to relapse into this situation where people are running across crossroads again because snipers are firing, where sniper barriers are going up again, where shelling is happening all around the town. I spoke to a family a few weeks ago whose daughter had gone out for a game of volleyball, and she never came back. I mean, 19 years old, and a piece of shrapnel went through the base of her neck. That was the end of her. You know, parents were waiting at home for her to come home. She was supposed to come at 8:30. She didn't come. 9 o'clock, 9:30, 10 o'clock. Finally, they called the hospital and said, yeah, she's just come in. She's dead. These are the kinds of banal, almost at this point, horrors that the people of this city continue to go through. And the Bosnian Serbs, I suppose their thinking is that they can force the government here to the negotiating table by reducing the capital of this city to its knees. That's the only rationale, military rationale, I can see. Otherwise, it's simply a prolonged form of terror. Right now, they're again using utilities as a weapon of war. Since the NATO bombing, electricity's out. Water's out, gas out.
So what do people do at night? Just sit alone in the dark in their apartments?
Yeah, then there's no light. You see people with wheelbarrows carting water around town. They have no... I mean, they have candles and and other improvised means.
What do you do at night?
People here hate candles. They say they used to find them romantic. Now they just despise them.
What do you do at night?
It's a symbol of their degradation. What do? I usually file to the New York Times until, I don't know, 9 or 9:10 in the evening, and then I go down to the what used to be the discotheque at the Holiday Inn, and it's the safest place here because it's in the basement, and it's now the restaurant. And I go and eat something. I mean, when things are quieter here, I sometimes go out for a meal with other journalists. Or I mean, there's a very limited number of things to do. I have a few friends in Sarajevo now whom I try to see, but. The city lives completely abnormally. There's a curfew at 10 p.m. Now journalists are generally not bothered by the Bosnian authorities if they're out after that. In theory, there is a curfew.
My guest is Roger Cohen. He's in Sarajevo covering the war for the New York Times. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Roger Cohen is joining us by phone from Sarajevo, where he's covering the war for the New York Times. How visible are peacekeepers in Sarajevo since some peacekeepers were taken hostage?
They're visible. They're still out on the street. They're in a much more aggressive posture than normally. I approached a French base called Skenderia yesterday in my vehicle, which is a white one. It's got New York Times written on it, and the French soldier didn't hesitate. When I was 40 yards away, he pointed a rocket-propelled grenade directly at me. Never seen that before. Of course, I stopped the car. I got out, and I walked the rest of the way. He did that because, as I said, all these vehicles had been stolen by the Serbs when they took the hostages, including 6 light tanks with night vision equipment and very sophisticated electronic gadgetry, the highest sophistication of tanks available in the West at the moment. Nobody knows if they can use them, but they might well be able to. Now, in the streets, you see guns are being pointed at people with very little hesitation. The French, of course, lost a base when the one they retook in the commander raid when the Serbs infiltrated disguised as French peacekeepers. So there's a great deal of nervousness. They're out on the streets patrolling, but there's an atmosphere that I characterize as jumpy and unpredictable, and there's a sense of some drift, you know, that something has changed. We're going somewhere new, but we don't know where it is, and we don't know how this is going to be resolved.
Now, are the Serbs making photo opportunities available to photographers and TV cameras of the hostages chained to bridges?
No, they're not. What they're doing is they are... they filmed them themselves with a so-called Bosnian Serb television, and then distributed these images to CNN and to others. They haven't actually, to my knowledge, let anybody speak to these hostages. The commanders of these men are unable to speak to them, and journalists are unable to speak to them, and nobody has a precise idea where they are, which is why, as I said, a rescue operation would be extremely difficult because their whereabouts are not known. I mean, an alternative, of course, Terry, could be to attack the Serbs directly. Then you're really at war with them. That's something else.
You've said that there's a lot of nervous tension in Sarajevo now as people wait to see what happens next. What are some of the scenarios you've been hearing that are going through people's minds when they think about what's going to happen next?
I think they feel that it can't go on. They feel that they've been here 3 years, surrounded. And now the UN did do something different, the UN and NATO. That's to say, they bombed a militarily significant target in a bid to demonstrate to the Serbs that the shelling of this town, this European capital, will no longer be tolerated. However, I don't think the people here have a clear idea of how the siege could be lifted. They're skeptical after all this time as to whether Western countries are willing to use further force, and they're waiting to see. It's possible that greater force will be used. I expect personally that there'll be a waiting period of several days in which there'll be a lot of psychological pressure on the Serbs, NATO jets swooping over and very firm declarations. France has called a meeting of NATO defense ministers in Paris on Saturday and European Union defense ministers to discuss possible measures. And I think Karadzic, the Bosnian Serb leader, is really a pariah at this point. There were rumors running around Sarajevo today that he'd been killed. That's not true. But that shows, I think, the psychological state here. There's a lot of rumors, a lot of uncertainty, but a feeling also that something has come to a head. A French officer said to me today, "I don't know where we're going, but we're going somewhere." And I think that sort of sums it up.
Have you found that there's in general anger or defense of the NATO bombing that in turn, you know, led the Serbs to take the hostages and so on?
You mean among the United Nations soldiers here, or among
the people of the population of Sarajevo that you've been in touch with?
I think they were satisfied and pleased to see the bombing. Of course, they would have liked it to go further. They probably understand that with the hostages, it's difficult to pursue that method. They've been outraged, Terry, by what's happened over the last 3 years. They don't believe in anything anymore. They're pretty exhausted, and they're in a strange, almost surreal state of mind. It's hard to convey to you, but you look out of your window in the morning here and you see completely deserted streets. You lie in your bed and you listen to mortars, rockets, cannons going off. We journalists come in and out. These people are here all the time, and they've reached a point of a complete psychological exhaustion, I'd say. So they're not sure what to expect from NATO next. They're pleased they did something, and they want this city to be open to the world. That's their bottom line, and they're waiting for that. They've become very cynical. You know, they switch on their TV and they see all these ministers in their suits and ties sitting around tables in Brussels or Holland. And I must say, even I, as a journalist here, I feel the same. I come in touch every day with tremendous personal suffering. And you see these people gathering yet again to review the situation in Bosnia yet again, to decide what to do yet again. And to these people, what they see are people who've been incapable of a decisive response against a force that they perceive as evil. They perceive the people who have shelled their children, who have hounded tens, hundreds of thousands of people into concentration camps, not Nazi death camps, not death factories, but still camps where a lot of people were killed and where everyone was abused. They feel that there's right and wrong here, that there's evil and that there's some better force. And they feel that this force of evil must be dealt with before there can be peace in this country.
Roger Cohen is in Sarajevo covering the war for the New York Times. Our conversation, which was recorded earlier today, will continue in the second part of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up on Fresh Air, covering a postmodern war, we continue our conversation from Sarajevo with Roger Cohn of the New York Times about what it's like to cover the war in Bosnia and what makes this war different from other wars. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews two new summer thrillers, The Rainmaker by John Grisham and Poison by Katherine Harrison. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. France is calling for a summit of European Union defense ministers this weekend to discuss Bosnia. From Paris, Lynn Terry has more.
Prime Minister Alain Juppé told Parliament during a briefing on Bosnia that France has called for a NATO and EU summit to discuss new tactics for the UN peacekeepers in Bosnia and their redeployment. He said the defense ministers would also discuss French proposals to create a rapid reaction force to be able to intervene more quickly and protect the peacekeepers. Juppé said the extra 1,000 troops that Britain has sent to Bosnia could contribute to the force, along with the 500 elite French troops that France has sent to the region. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
Meanwhile, Secretary of State Warren Christopher says tough negotiations are ahead with Serbia's president. Christopher is sending a diplomat to Belgrade. He says the mission is to drive a wedge between Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic and Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic. The Bosnian Serbs rely on Serbia for support. Christopher's envoy will offer Serbia an end to an international trade embargo in exchange for recognition of Bosnia and Croatia. Christopher is dismissing questions about whether U.S. troops could help redeploy United Nations peacekeepers, but President Clinton says such a request would be considered. The European Union has formally asked the United States that it be included in talks on the Japanese-U.S. trade dispute over cars. From London, NPR's Michael Goldfarb report.
The request was made in Geneva, headquarters of the World Trade Organization, the international referee for trade disputes. The U.S. and Japan are sidestepping their way towards a preliminary meeting there in mid-June to discuss the U.S. decision to impose punitive tariffs on Japanese luxury cars because Japan, in the U.S. view, is denying American auto manufacturers access to its market. The European Union is concerned about the implication of the U.S. action on two fronts. First, that the decision was made unilaterally, without reference to the World Trade Organization. Second, that in resolving the dispute, the U.S. might gain special access to the Japanese market. Last week, the EU's Trade Commissioner, Sir Leon Britton, criticized the U.S. for imposing the tariffs. He said, "I do not favor the use of threats." I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin says the United States is active in currency exchange markets. He says the U.S. has followed up international meetings last month that focused on concerns over the value of the dollar. The Bank of France confirmed that it joined the Federal Reserve and other European central banks to support the dollar. The United States has purchased dollars before on international exchange markets to stabilize the dollar's value. On Wall Street, stock prices closed higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average set a new record high. The Dow skyrocketed more than 86 points to close at 4,465 today. Advances led to declines by a margin of 3-1 in very heavy trading. This is NPR. The government reports the economy slowed down in the first 3 months of this year. Inflation picked up steam. The first quarter report on the gross domestic product has been revised to 2.7%. That is slightly weaker than was first thought a month ago. The government says one measure of inflation tied to the GDP was up 3%, and that is stronger than first thought. These revisions are surprising economists. Attempts to stem the flow of people illegally crossing into the United States are working, according to a report released today in Washington. But a recent surge in illegal crossings is a crucial test for the administration's immigration policy. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
The Center for Immigration Studies looked at border operations at El Paso and San Diego, two popular crossing points for illegal immigrants. Director John Martin says they found apprehensions at El Paso dropped to 25% of the previous year's rate after Operation Hold the Line was put in place. In San Diego, apprehensions were down 14%, but in the high-volume Imperial Beach area, they were down 40% thanks to Operation Gatekeeper. But in the past 5 months, the numbers have risen again, largely due to the collapse of the Mexican peso, and Arizona has become a new favorite crossing point. Martin says the numbers over the coming year will tell if it's possible to sustain the effort made so far, or if the border is simply too big to seal. I'm Peter Kenyon in Washington.
The two sons and two partners of late publishing magnate Robert Maxwell have gone on trial in London for fraud. The four are accused of misusing pension fund assets from Maxwell's companies. All four plead innocent. The charges stem from the collapse of Maxwell's publishing empire after his death at sea, November 1991. Prosecutors allege money belonging to the pension funds was used as collateral for bank overdrafts by Maxwell firms. They say the Maxwells then sold the shares owned by the pension funds and used the proceeds to benefit Maxwell companies. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with the second part of our conversation with Roger Cohen. He's in Sarajevo, covering the war in the former Yugoslavia for the New York Times. In the first part of our show, we talked about the current escalation of the war. Cohen said Sarajevo is in a state of nervous exhaustion. Our conversation was recorded earlier today. You had a wonderful piece in the Times a couple of Sundays ago, I think it was, in which you described Bosnia as an example of a new kind of postmodern war. And you told the story of a young man who was hit by a sniper outside the Holiday Inn and was left paralyzed from the waist down. Tell us a little bit about what happened to him and how that just kind of typifies what separates this war from other wars.
Thank you for what you said about the article. I think that what I've just been talking about is summed up in a way in this incident. As I said, people here are very cynical. They feel the world has sat and watched while a city and a country have been dismembered. And what happened in this particular instance is that a 20-year-old boy, very well educated, he was studying engineering, and is a highly intelligent young man. I spoke to him for quite a long time. He was walking along outside my hotel, outside the Holiday Inn. He was shot by a sniper. The bullet grazed his lung and then went through part of his spine and left him a paraplegic. And I went to see him in the hospital because he's a friend of a friend of mine here. I didn't realize that this would actually... All the time here, you just meet people and it builds into a story because everyone's been through so much. But the first thing he said to me was, you want to see the video? I said, what video? He said, well, I've got a video of when I was paralyzed, when I was shot. I said, yeah, of course I'd like to see it. And so he handed me this video and we watched it. And on the video, you see this lithe young man walking down the street. The wind's blowing and his hair is kind of ruffled, and he sets out across the street in front of the Holiday Inn. There's the crack of a sniper's bullet being fired, and it echoes. Everything echoes here because you're in a valley. And he falls. And he falls on his side, and then he kind of curls up into this fetal position, and his name is Faruk Shabanovich. He said that he felt his legs and his chest. That was the first thing he felt, and then he saw his feet, which appeared to him very distant, and he tried to move them but couldn't. And then he saw this UN soldier standing 20 meters away, and you see this on film, and the UN soldier doesn't move. He's just paralyzed by fear, the United Nations soldier. And this, to me, was an image of the paralysis of this mission until last week. And why was it filmed? Because people are shot so regularly outside the Holiday Inn that cameramen now just come and stand there, and if they stand for a few hours, they will very likely get a live image of somebody being killed or maimed. And so that's how Mr. Shabanovich got his video. Now, this to me was an image of the war. You had a civilian being shot, for no reason. I'm just a civilian walking on a street. The UN standing by, helpless, paralyzed, frightened, uncertain what to do. A cameraman there because the war has got to a point after 3 years where you can even predict where people are going to be killed. It's become so predictable what goes on here that you have cameramen standing around at particular points just waiting for the inevitable shooting of somebody. And this collage, to me, was an image of the war. And at that time, as it happened, I'd been talking to some people about this war who'd been using this phrase of postmodern or future war to describe the wars that you've seen in Chechnya and here, which are not conventional wars between states and between armies, such as you saw in the First World War or the Second World War or even in the Gulf War, where highly sophisticated weaponry was developed and then used. I mean, here you have fragmented, chaotic wars in which civilians are in the middle, in which you have societies breaking down into sometimes tribal groupings and not a very sophisticated level of weaponry because these are not highly coordinated or sophisticated armies. Weapons like artillery being used simply as weapons of terror when they were not conceived to do that. They were not conceived to be fired on towns. They were conceived to support infantry. Some people are calling these wars postmodern wars because they feel that wars between states, given the fact that the atomic bomb is now a fact of life, wars, conventional wars between states, they see becoming increasingly uncommon, and these kind of chaotic wars in which civilians are simply cast in the midst of chaos, and perhaps the UN also finds itself in the midst of chaos trying to mediate and palliate the situation. These are more and more the kinds of wars that many analysts expect to see. So I think this image of a civilian being shot on a street on camera with the UN looking on was quite a powerful image of that kind of conflict.
Roger Cohn is my guest. He's a New York Times reporter who's covering the war in the former Yugoslavia. He's joining us by phone from Sarajevo. I wonder if, as a reporter in Sarajevo, you ever feel like you have your own existential crisis in this postmodern war.
Well, I do. It's as I said earlier, Terry, it's extremely hard to communicate to people outside what a surreal and sordid and terrible situation it is in Sarajevo. We're all trained to be objective and to not to take sides, but I'd really defy anybody who spends any time in the city not to empathize to some extent with the people here. I spend a lot of time in Pale on the Bosnian Serb side too. Needless to say, there are a lot of fine people over there. Unfortunately, I think what they've done in many instances has simply been monstrous. But I feel that I've understood, certainly as I said, the build-up to the Second World War much better. I mean, what you see here is the hypocrisy of people and the immense luxury and the ease of most of our lives compared to the suffering of people in a war. And this is a war that's very close at hand. My family's in Paris. And when I go back to Paris and I go to the market or something and see, these overflowing stands of 8 different types of mushrooms and 5 different types of oranges and, every spice and herb on the planet. And, we don't realize the, perhaps often, the immense luxury in which we live. And there is this disconnect between the real suffering of people in Bosnia and the very nearby prosperity. And it's caused me to think a lot about about governments and politicians, and the way they've treated this conflict has been essentially dictated by their desire not to get involved. And that's a fact, and this desire of theirs is understandable. But it has also caused great suffering to the people here. The United States was aware in August 1992 that people were being thrown into camps, concentration camps in Europe. Bosnia has no overwhelming or direct strategic interest for the United States, but the United States, in my view, stands for certain moral and ethical values of which concentration camps are the antithesis. Now, we've let that go by. We've delivered aid, but we've let it go by, basically. And I believe that we will, over the years, probably pay a price for that, because a certain kind of behavior has been tolerated that hadn't been tolerated in Europe for a very long time. And I don't think that such things just drift off into the ether. I think the seeping through and down can be very slow.
My guest is Roger Cohen. He's in Sarajevo, covering the war for the New York Times. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with New York Times reporter Roger Cohn. He's speaking to us from Sarajevo. Remember, you were talking before about how some photographers will set up their equipment on certain streets, knowing that if they just wait there patiently, someone's going to get hit by a sniper and they'll have a dramatic picture.
Right.
I wonder if things like that also put you through existential crises as a journalist about what you want your role to be.
Yeah, I wouldn't like to have to do that job at all. I mean, there's always this tension for a journalist between having to stand back and observe and identification with the people, particularly in a war or in situations of great suffering, whom you are observing. I believe that the best journalism comes from passion. I don't believe that you can write great stories, certainly in a war, through being strenuously dispassionate. I think you have to try to identify strongly and passionately with the people that you see. Now, there comes the question again then of, are you doing anything useful? I think that some of the pieces I've written have had some effect. That's some small comfort to me in a way. I mean, I wrote, for example, about a music school last year, the Sarajevo Music School, which was going through enormous difficulty. The students had been killed, the shells that had gone through the roof, the fact that none of the instruments worked anymore, the lack of heating. The response was unbelievable from New York, from Chicago, from Vermont. Some wonderful people called, and lo and behold, suddenly this music school is getting all kinds of things. I felt at times that one or two things I've written have played into, of course, they haven't determined them, but have at least played to some extent into some shifts of policy that maybe have been positive. But there is this, there's no getting away from it, Sarah. You do feel, could you be doing more? Should you be doing more? I've helped one or two people get out of here. I said to myself I wouldn't do that when I came here, but there comes a point where you see people you know over long periods, you know, over a year, a couple of years, who are just at the end of their rope. And do you, as somebody who has a vehicle that's armored and has the means to get out of here, which they don't, do you say, you know, as a journalist, you know, it's not the right thing to do to take these people out? Or do you say, damn it, as a human being, I want to help this person? And it doesn't really make any difference to anything. I mean, these are just civilians, you know, they're not government officials or anything like that.
Roger, what's your best guess about what story you're going to be covering a week from now?
That's a very good question, Terry. I think things, as I've said, are in a very unpredictable phase. I feel that something has snapped. It's not meltdown, but it's, there's been this weird kind of holding pattern here for a while where you've had peacekeepers on the ground, NATO in the air, you know, NATO strikes, peacekeepers are in danger, and nothing moves. I think something, you know, is going to move, whether it's some military action here to release these hostages, or some shake-up in Pale, where, as I said, I think the Bosnian Serbs have crossed some frontier that it'll be very difficult to come back from. I sense that the crisis in Bosnia is, the war in Bosnia is moving towards not a definitive crisis, but certainly a substantial change, which I don't think will necessarily play out over a week, but perhaps over the next month or two. I would suspect that a week from now there'll still be hostages, and I think the drumbeat of Western military build-up will continue. I don't think there's going to be any stepping down from the United States on this one. I don't think we're going to negotiate on these hostages. I can't imagine that.
Well, Roger Cohen, I want to wish you good luck, and I thank you very much for spending some time with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Roger Cohen spoke to us from Sarajevo. He's covering the war in Bosnia for the New York Times. Our interview was recorded earlier today. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what do you have on the Clinton administration's latest position on Bosnia?
Hi, Terry. President Clinton is saying he will consider the temporary use of U.S. ground troops in Bosnia to help the United Nations peacekeepers reposition their forces. Other stories tonight, Elizabeth Arnold tells us how Congress is reacting to this idea and what the presidential candidates are saying about Bosnia. I'll talk with a BBC reporter in Sakhalin Island who's covering the aftermath of the earthquake at Neftogorsk. Also, Joe Palka reports on new evidence that the Maya culture may have disappeared from Central America because of a severe drought. And Maria Martin reports on singer-songwriter Tish Inahosa.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This summer's entertainment thrills and chills aren't only to be found in the movies. In the first part of a two-part summer reading roundup, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews two new suspense novels. One is about a daredevil lawyer. The other is about a pair of women accused of doing the devil's work.
I live in Washington, D.C., where there are more lawyers drifting around than pollen spores, and all of them read John Grisham. That was enough to put me off him permanently, but I was sick last week and my defenses were down, so I gave in and read The Rainmaker. Now I'm not sneering at Grisham anymore. Not only did I inhale the novel in one frantic day, but I actually found myself rooting for the lawyer hero to make big bucks. The Rainmaker proves once again that art is dangerous. When the novel begins, Rudy Baylor, who is about to graduate from Memphis State Law School, learns that the firm he'd lined up a job with has just gone out of business. Rudy is flat broke, and so he desperately begins airdropping his resume all over Memphis, but no nibbles. Finally, an ambulance chaser nicknamed Bruiser hires him. Life looks grim, but Rudy holds one wild card. As a law student, Rudy gave free legal assistance to some senior citizens, and he stumbled upon a shocking case of insurance company fraud. While still working for Bruiser, Rudy takes the headline-making case to trial, going mano a mano against a firm of tassel-loafered legal eagles. The suspense of The Rainmaker derives from the way it deftly manipulates professional class fears and fantasies. After his graduation, Rudy discovered that his law degree, which was supposed to be his ticket out of the working poor, is just a piece of paper. But now, if he miraculously beats the big boys and wins this case, he'll gain entrance into the wealthy elite. On the surface, The Rainmaker is an exciting David and Goliath morality tale. But deep down, it's really a white-knuckle thriller about finding and keeping a good job. In 17th century Spain, people had even bigger worries. There was widespread starvation, the plague, and the Spanish Inquisition. But forget your Monty Python memories of heretics yucking it up on the rack. In Catherine Harrison's lavish nightmare of a suspense novel, Poison, the Inquisition is nothing to laugh about. Poison tells the parallel stories of two doomed women. Francisca de Luarca, the daughter of a silk grower, dares fate by learning to read and sleeping with the village priest. Marie Louise de Bourbon is wed to Carlos, the impotent king of Spain. As years pass, the royal court blames Marie for the lack of heirs, and she starts faking miscarriages to convince them of her fertility and to try to save her life. I'm no expert on 17th century Spain, so I can't vouch for the accuracy of Harrison's historical detail, only for the atmosphere of Baroque menace it conjures up. We hear how soldiers of the Inquisition cut out their horses' tongues and wrapped their hooves in cloth so that they could ride up on their victims in silence. We also learn about crazed Carlos's health habits, how he drank only mother's milk and bathed in penitents' tears. Harrison's narrators tell their stories in charged poetic language that sounds slightly archaic without feeling fake. At one point, for instance, a grief-stricken Francisca describes her emotional state as two mirrors with nothing in between, a blank cold winter of feeling. Lots of fine writers, from Tennyson to Barbara Tuchman, have resuscitated the Middle Ages. In Poison, Catherine Harrison makes you rejoice that they're long gone.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Rainmaker by John Grisham and Poison by Catherine Harrison. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.